what this is at this point. And I'll talk about some ways to use this Gaussian free field, which is this very simple two-dimensional analog of Brownian motion, to construct some random geometries and try to use those to say something about SLEs. So references, so there's a kind of survey paper I have that will be in PTRF, Gaussian Free Fields for Mathematicians. There's also a Harmonic Explorer with Oded Schramm, and these two papers together were then used in this paper, which is our very long, 100-some page paper, contour lines of the Gaussian free field.
Do you need the lights or you don't need the lights?
Better. Oh, you know, I wanted all but the middle lights, but maybe that doesn't work. Huh?
It's not. It's shining to the side.
Is it? Should we turn it off? Why don't we turn it off? I can turn them off and turn them on again. And
no, that was the other one.
It's the
best
one.
Yeah. So is this better?
Yeah, that's better. But
and then I can leave this close
to
you.
No.
The other one. Turn off the.
Yeah.
Turn it off. Yeah. Turn the lights on. Yes. Turn on the board.
Okay. Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Then we have a couple other papers. Describing loop ensembles, and there are more things in the works, and you can see on my webpage all the figures and things that I'm presenting today. Okay, so SLE motivated goals we have. So what we'd like to do is construct a random geometry of some sort, I'll put that in quotes for now, in which these SLE curves and SLE loops, what I call the conformal loop ensembles, appear naturally as geometric objects. And, okay, so that's sort of a vague goal, but we'll see how that can be done. The second goal would be to try to understand what I like to call this Duplantier duality, which is this relationship between SLE kappa and SLE 16 over kappa. And our approach to understanding this would be really realizing both of these objects within the same geometry. Essentially, this is a phenomenon that was, I guess, conjectured by Rhoda and Schramm and others, and I think I'm correct that Duplantier was the first to sort of observe this, although maybe others have been involved in that as well, which was really to note the idea that the boundary of an SLE kappa when kappa is bigger than 4 should look like an SLE 16 over kappa. Then we'll see something special about the self-dual value, kappa equals 4, which is equal to 16 over kappa. And these Gaussian free field stories will help us understand why we should have a time reversal symmetry for SLE. One way of seeing that. Okay, so first, what is the Gaussian free field? Well, the standard Gaussian on an n-dimensional Hilbert space is just the random variable with the density function e to the minus, well, the inner product of v, point in the space, with itself divided by 2 times the appropriate constant. And as you know, you can write a sample from this distribution as the sum I equals 1 to n of alpha sub I v sub I, where the v sub I are a basis, an orthonormal basis for this inner product, and the alpha sub I's are independent unit variants, zero mean Gaussians, normal random variables. Okay, so it just says, you know, take an orthonormal basis, each individual component will be an independent Gaussian. Okay, now the discrete Gaussian free field is constructed as follows. So if I give you a graph, any graph, let me draw here a graph. Okay, this is a graph, some vertices. And if I give you two functions, f and g, defined on the vertices of this graph, real functions, I'll define the Dirichlet inner product to be just the sum over all the edges in the graph. So I'll write it this way, Dirichlet inner product of f and g is a sum over all pairs x adjacent to y of the change in F as you go from X to Y times the change in G when you go from X to Y. Particularly the inner product of F with itself, I'll write that H of F, and that's called the Dirichlet energy, and that is the sum over all edges of the change in F squared across that edge. So it's the L2 norm of the gradient of F, if you like. So this H of F, you can see it will be zero if you have a constant function. And in general, the more the function varies, fluctuates from the larger this value will be. So now, to get the discrete gas, if we field, I'll fix a function F naught on the boundary vertices. So maybe 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, some function on these boundary vertices. If this is a planar graph, I can just take the ones on the outer face and call them the boundary. In general, I can pick an arbitrary set of vertices, call them the boundary vertices. So I'll fix this on the boundary. And then the set of functions F that agree with F naught on the boundary is just an n-dimensional space, isomorphic to Rn, and is the number of interior vertices. And the discrete Gauss-free field is just a random element of this space with probability density proportional to e to the minus h of f over 2. And again, h is this Dirichlet energy. Okay, so that's all. And this h, this is the potential energy for a mesh of harmonic oscillators. If you think you have a network of springs sitting together and you try to pull some of them up to other heights and push some of them down to other heights, this is, h is the amount of energy. And so we're just sampling the probability proportional e to the minus this energy over 2. And here I actually did this on a 20 by 20 grid. And you can see what this surface looks like inside. So on a 20 by 20 grid, you can see that there is some fluctuation. When I look at nearest neighbor vertices, I have jumps in the order of, I don't know, one or two. But I wouldn't expect to see a jump, say, of size 10 in the middle. Because what's 10 squared? It's 100. So e to the minus 100 is very small. So 100 would just contribute such a large amount to the energy, it just wouldn't be worth it to have things like that. So you don't have any jumps of size 10. You'd have to get a very big box before you would see jumps of size 10 anyway. Okay, so some properties of this discrete Gaussian free field. First, if you have zero boundary conditions, then this Dirichlet form is an inner product. This basic function is zero boundary, and this is a standard Gaussian on this space. If I give you other boundary conditions in the discrete Gaussian free field with, say, F naught as its boundary conditions, that it turns out to have the same law as the zero boundary discrete Gaussian free field plus the deterministic function. Well, that deterministic function is just the discrete harmonic interpolation of F naught to the whole graph. So discrete harmonic means that a function on a graph is discrete harmonic if the value at every interior vertex is the average of the values at the neighbors. So if I fix the values on the boundary, there is a unique discrete harmonic interpolation to the inside. And if you think about it, it's just, if I want to know what's the value of the discrete harmonic interpolation in this vertex, that's equal to the expected value of the function at the, if I did a random walk starting at this point, it stopped it when it hit the boundary, and that's what's the expected value of the function at the terminal point. That expected value will be the value of this discrete harmonic interpolation here. The same as what you get for Brownian motion with harmonic functions. And okay, so now, I have this Markov property, which is another property of the discrete Gaussian free field. It says that conditioned on the values of F on the boundary of some subgraph of my graph. So let's condition on, say, these values, maybe some chunk of the graph. I condition on all the values here. What's the conditional law of the heights elsewhere? Well, it's just going to be a new Gaussian free field with boundary conditions given by the values I observed. Okay, this may seem sort of obvious from people who work in statistical physics. This Markov property just comes from the fact that we have nearest neighbor interactions, and that's all. So given this, the Gaussian free field with these boundary conditions. Okay. Now, the continuum Gaussian free field. That's the discrete Gaussian free field. How would you define a continuum version of this? Well, a continuum Gaussian free field, it's what you think. It's a standard Gaussian on a Hilbert space. But in this case, we have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So how do we construct that? Okay, I give you a planar domain D. Let H of D be the Hilbert space closure of the set of smooth, compactly supported functions on D under this Dirichlet inner product. Okay, this Dirichlet inner product of functions F1 and F2 is the integral over D of the dot product of their gradients. Gradient of F1 dot the gradient of F2. In particular, the Dirichlet energy, or the inner product of a function f with itself, will just be the integral of, well, the norm of the gradient squared. This is the L2 norm of the gradient. So basically, I have a Hilbert space whose norm is given by this L2 norm of the gradient, I guess squared, to get the Dirichlet energy. And now what I say is the Gaussian free field is just the formal sum. H is the sum of alpha sub I, f sub I, where the f sub I's are an orthonormal basis for H, and the alpha sub I's are IID Gaussians. So mean zero unit variance. And, okay, so we all know that this sum doesn't converge pointwise. In fact, and it certainly doesn't converge even in, say, L2. So why is that? So it's clear that if I look at a function like, or if I give you any Hilbert space that's infinite dimensional and ask for a standard Gaussian on that Hilbert space, that means each of the components is I take an orthonormal basis, each of the components is going to be an independent Gaussian. So what's the norm of this thing I get? Well, it's the sum of the squares of these independent integrals. Well, the sum of the squares is almost surely infinite. So this comes up all over in math and physics. When you take a standard Gaussian on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, you have an object, a random object, that does not actually live in the Hilbert space. So you have to define it in some larger space, say. It's one way of doing this. So this formal sum, it doesn't converge in the space it doesn't converge in H of D in my Hilbert space. You can show it almost surely diverges pointwise. So this H doesn't really make sense as a function, but it does converge, say, in the space of distributions. So that means if I want to look at the integral of H against a smooth function, if phi is smooth, I'll just write that H as though it were an inner product. H of phi, I'll use this notation. So just the integral of H times phi over the domain. That sort of makes sense. So the average, it's sort of a weighted average of H, where you're weighting by a smooth function. So this makes sense. And when I say it makes sense, I mean that if I look at the partial sums of this integrated against phi, the partial sums times phi integrated over the domain, each of those makes sense. And you almost surely get a limit for every phi. Okay, so this is a random, H makes sense as a random distribution. In fact, you can make sense of the average value of H on a disk or something is well defined. So I guess most people here know something about the Gaussian free field, but what we don't is sometimes are getting used to it first that this is not a function. But it's not such as frightening an object as you might think. For example, if I give you any disk, and I give you its center R, or radius R on its center Z, and ask for the average on this disk, that's going to be a well-defined object. And so this is just going to, so I can view my Gaussian free field as just a function of Z and R. So it's not defined at points, but it's defined, its average on disks is defined. It's a it'll be a random continuous function of Z and R. And but the problem is that if you fix Z and then you let R shrink, then this function will actually look like a Brownian motion. And it will go with respect to the log of the radius. And so as it shrinks, it'll oscillate between plus and minus infinity. And you won't have any limit at a point. So it really is not defined at a point. Okay, yes. Well, I mean, you know the answer to this question, probably. It's
you're
just asking.
It's an oral exam.
What's that? No, so phi, I mean,
it can just be supported on an interval.
It can be supported on a line, right. It just can't quite be a point. It has to be something bigger than, it can be supported on a Cantor set. I mean, basically, this, right, so the way you think of it is this function h, it doesn't live in L2, but it sort of barely fails to live in L2. In the sense that if you take the inverse Laplacian to any power, if you take the Laplacian to any positive power of h, or to any negative power, I guess, then it nudges it into L2. So anything bigger than zero, it nudges it into L2. So it sort of just barely doesn't make sense as a function. So that's in dimensions two. In other dimensions, it fails to be a function more severely. Yes? Yeah, that's right. So if you were to write the, so if you were to, you know, let's say we do this on a, So, basically, you have So when they talk about color spaces, you have say I look at, let's look at this thing on a torus, say. And I have a function sub mn will just be my exponential function, which waves m times in this direction, n times in this direction. And so I'm going to have a sum of mn times f of mn. And so I want some sort of the sum of alpha mn times the norm of this vector, mn squared, to converge. Is that right? Am I getting the power wrong on this? This to some power.
And then to the
one.
What is it? The one power.
To the one?
Just
the norm?
Something like that.
Something like this converges. Right. And then if I take the Laplacian of this, then that has the effect of multiplying each mn, each alpha sub mn, by this norm squared. And, okay, so you can, so it multiplies each of these by this norm squared. And, okay, the point is, if you want to get a function, you can multiply each of these by this norm to some smaller power. I don't know, do people really care about this? No one cares, okay, fine. If you don't care, you shouldn't ask. But this is the So now, here's what we do. So I'll give you a, I'm going to define a function here on the vertices of this graph. And what I've done here is I've taken a function, and I'm just showing you the signs of this function. So it's a function defined on the vertices of this graph. And when it's positive, I'm showing you white. And when it's negative, I'm showing you black. And I have kind of fixed the values of this function to be some negative thing on this boundary, some positive thing on this boundary. And then I chose the values inside according, say, some Gaussian field, and then colored each of them according to the sign. OK, now, this is now a function defined on vertices. If I want to talk about level lines, the Gaussian free field, which I do, and then it makes sense to have a continuous function defined on this whole set. So what I'll do is just piecewise linearly interpolate to each on each triangle. So I fix the values on the corners, and there's an affine interpolation to the inside. And so that gives me a continuous function. And if I want to define a level line of this function, well, let's just look at one level line. I know that this function will take the value 0 somewhere between this negative and this positive value. So let's look at the 0 level line that starts at this vertex.
So, it was that interpolation that was shown in the three-dimensional plot, right?
Well, the three-dimensional plot was not on a triangular lattice. It was on a grid. And it just used Mathematica's surface body. It wasn't exactly
well,
this.
Well, a square lattice, you wouldn't be able to do.
A square lattice, well, you can pick, you know, you can cut your squares in half and diagonally into triangles, but it wouldn't be as canonical a way of doing it. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there are many ways to interpolate. Okay. So now what I've done is there'll be a level line that takes the value 0 here. It goes from some point on this edge to some point on this edge where I have the value 0. And some point on this edge to some point on this edge. Some point on this edge. And so just knowing the signs, I can tell you generally where this path is going. Okay. And the nice thing is if I look at the dual picture where I replace each vertex here with a hexagon, then the lines that this path goes through, the edges that this path goes through are exactly the duals of the edges that I'm tracing now, which are the kind of the boundaries between this black cluster of hexagons that touches the boundary and the white cluster that touches the boundary. So if I'm interested in really the fine mesh limits, I take a fine grid. And I want to look at level lines of this picture, it's enough to look at interfaces between black and white in a picture like this. And so I'm going to use this for most of my pictures. It's easier to see somehow. So this theorem with Odette in this very long paper I mentioned is that if the initial boundary heights are lambda on one boundary arc and minus lambda on the complementary arc, where lambda is a special constant, root pi over 8, then the scaling limit of the zero height interface, as the mesh size tends to 0, will be SLE4.
These initial boundary heights, you mean that the half shell on either side of you?
Yes, that's right. That's right. So if I take these values, I set these black ones to be minus lambda, I set these white ones to be plus lambda. I choose the inside ones according to the Gaussian free field. Look at the interface, it will look like SLE4. And if the initial boundary values are instead some other multiple of lambda, say I replace lambda with 1 plus a times lambda. So I put in an a lambda here, and I replace lambda here with 1 plus b times lambda on the right side. If I do that, then the loss of the path converts to one of these so-called SLE kappa rho processes, SLE4AB, which, don't worry if you haven't heard of it, but just I want to point out that we know what the answer is. What's that?
Rho
is a multi-index. So rho 1, rho 2, SLE kappa, and then you have what are all force points. Okay. So here, I'll show you a picture of this. I actually set these values to be minus lambda on this side, plus lambda on this side. This is a 90 by 90 grid. I ran this on a Mathematica simulation and drew the interface. There it is. So this should look like SLE4. Yes?
So this lambda, special value of lambda, square root pi over 8, is that lattice dependent constant?
Well, okay, I sort of glossed over something here. Maybe that is the value that comes up if you choose. So when I define the Gaussian refueler, it's actually sort of an arbitrary constant. I could multiply it by a constant as I wish. If I choose the normalization to be such that in the scaling limit I get the continuum Gaussian free field, as long as I choose it so that I get the continuum Gaussian free field in the limit, then this will be the value of lambda.
So it's not dependent on whether you're a square lattice or a triangle?
Yeah, it doesn't depend on...
It's a quantification radius.
It has to do with... it has to do with, I guess, quantification radius. Is that your word for it? Okay, yeah. Sure, it's whatever multiple of the Gaussian free field you converge to in the limit. And that's what determines lambda. I mean, the Gaussian free field is, I like to think, is sort of a canonical one. It's where you take this L2 norm of the gradient, gives your energy. And so here's the continuum plot of what I just did before. So I plugged this into a Mathematica surface plotter, and I tried to view it as a 90 by 90 grid, this rhombus I had. And you can kind of follow the level line here if you've got really good eyes. It's a little tricky. But now here's something that's maybe a little easier to visualize. What I did here is I said, let's imagine as I generate this path, I only observe the heights on the hexagons that I need to in order to draw the path. If I could start drawing it dynamically, each time I get to a new hexagon that my path hasn't run into before, I have to say, is the height positive or negative on this hexagon? And if it's positive, I turn left. If it's negative, I turn right. So I'll mark down what the value is on that hexagon. And then at the end of the day, when I've drawn the whole path, I have observed the heights all along the left side and all along the right side of the path. But I don't know the heights anywhere else. But I have to color them some color. So what I'll do is for these other hexagons, the color represents the expected height at this hexagon, given the heights on all the hexagons I've seen so far. Now remember, by this Markov property, what is that expected height? It's just the harmonic interpolation of the values along the boundary. So it's, if I have lambda here and these observed values along here, then the discrete harmonic interpolation of these values is what I show here.
But how do you make the selection as you're generating the path? This I don't understand. Because you can't really make a process out of it, can you?
So
some harmonic. What was it?
Like a harmonic is. How do I make the selection? I observe the. You mean how do I do?
How do you decide this hexagon has to be plus or minus?
You first generate the entire field, but then only look at it at those.
That's what I was asking. Believe that. But
okay.
Is that really true?
All right. What I want you to imagine I did is that up to this point I have no knowledge of the field everywhere else, but I know, given the heights I've seen, there's some conditional law on this hexagon.
Mm-hmm.
And that conditional law, well, it's a Gaussian. It's a Gaussian random variable, and I can compute its mean. Its mean is the harmonic interpolation, and its variance is some Green's function. You can work it out. And so I just generate that, and I generate these one at a time.
So is that how you generate it?
But that's
well, when I actually run this on the computer, it's actually easier to just generate the whole thing at once, and then generate the whole field, then draw this path in, and then just say, okay, just conditioned on these values,
okay,
what would be
that's
then
completely fine.
you know, do the harmonic interpolation to here. Yeah, that's an easier way to program it than recomputing the Green's function. And
so you compute all the information, then you throw a lot of it away.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I show you the condition information given this.
Is that constant? Is that what you're saying from the picture?
So yeah, so what you notice on this picture is that it seems to be roughly a constant on this side, another constant on this side. Let me show you another picture that's even more clear. This is a surface plot of that. And what kind of jumps out at you is that even though I have all kinds of wild fluctuations here along the boundary, when I get just a few lattice spacings away on this side, or a few lattice spacings on this side, it really starts to look pretty much like a constant over here, another constant over here. And remember, I told you, you know, the height differences, they tend to be about on the order of 1 or something, 1 or 2. You don't see height gaps of size 10. So along this path, you don't see any gaps of size 10. You see, you know, 1 or 2. And what you want to say is, well, there's kind of, sort of as I move away, kind of the harmonic average of the heights along this path should be roughly some one constant on this side and another constant on this side. Okay, and that's a theorem, kind of proving that this is actually true in the limit. This was really the hardest part of my paper with Odette. And I want to stress that this height gap is not a function of the boundary conditions. So if I chose the boundary conditions to be, say, minus 3 lambda here and plus 3 lambda here, and then draw this path, what you see is it's still the case that the heights just a little bit to the left of this path are approximately minus lambda. The heights a little to the right are approximately plus lambda. But now what I see over here is, well, I've got minus lambda here harmonically shading up to minus 3 lambda along here. So this function here is the harmonic interpolation of the function, which is minus lambda here, and approximately minus lambda. Or sorry, minus 3 lambda here, minus 3 lambda here, and approximately minus lambda all the way along here. So this minus lambda really is kind of a special intrinsic value of the model. It's the height gap you, it doesn't depend on how I set up my boundary conditions. And so when I chose the value minus lambda here, plus lambda here, that was really the special value for which I would actually get a constant on this side and another constant on this side. Yes?
What happens if you don't have the opposite values, but you have this symmetry?
What happens if I...
If A and B are different.
Oh, if A and B are different? So I have, say, minus lambda here and 5 lambda over here or something. Well, then you'll get again one of these SLA kappa rho processes, but with, I mean, essentially, if I make this value smaller, the height here, then this path wants to be further over to the left, right? Because I'm making things more negative, so the zero set won't go. Wait, is that right? No, if I make the height here smaller, these are more negative. That's pushing this to the right. Yes, okay. If I make this really negative, that's pushing this to the right. If I make this really positive, that's pushing this to the left. And so sort of these values are putting competing forces on this, pushing it to the left to right. If I make both of these, if I make this 100 lambda, this minus 100 lambda, then they'll push this path so that it goes stays very close to the center. And here's the surface plot of that path. And again, it's sort of more clear here. You can see this step here is jumping up from minus lambda here up to lambda here. And the size of the step is roughly the same all along the path.
When the boundary value is smaller than lambda, what happens?
The boundary value is smaller. Well, one thing interesting that happens is that the continual limit of the path can't hit the boundary in that case, which it doesn't happen otherwise. But otherwise, I mean, it's still one of these SLE kappa rho processes. Just a variant of SLE. Okay, so post sketch of how we would prove something like this. So you observe that you can show that SLE4 is the only random path, gamma, with the following property. If I am given gamma up to time t, and let's say I condition on gamma up to some time t, and I ask, let's do this in a half plane. In a half plane, and I condition on the path up to time t and ask, what is the, you know, fix a point z and ask, what's the conditional law, conditional probability that z will ultimately be on the left side of the path? If I draw the whole path, it divides my plane into a left side and a right side. SLE4 is a random simple path. And so the conditional probability that z ends up on the left, given this, is just the harmonic interpolation of the function, which is 1 all the way along here, and 0 all the way along here. That's the probability this point ends up on the left. It's just this harmonic function. And it sort of makes sense that points close to the boundary, the probability will be close to 1, they end up on the left, and over here close to 0. I was telling you what's significant is that it's 0, or it's harmonic in the interior. Now, okay, now if you think about it, it means if I said, look at the function which is, minus lambda if z is on the left side, and plus lambda if z is on the right side, what's the expected value of that function, given this path so far? Well, the expected value of that function is, well, just, you know, this is a silly affine transformation of what I told you before. It's just the function which is harmonic interpolation of the function which is minus lambda here and plus lambda here. Okay. Now, so tell you SLE4 is the only path with this property. What I want to do is tell you that any scaling limit of these discrete paths has to have the same property. And why should that be true? Well, you think about it, if I really have this height gap lemma, then what is it that I know? Well, I really know that when I have these hexagons, when I draw a portion of the path and ask what's the conditional expected height of z, well, it's going to be approximately the harmonic interpolation of minus lambda here and plus lambda over here. It'll be discrete harmonic interpolation, but on a fine mesh, that's approximately the harmonic interpolation. And I also know that at the end of the day, when this path reaches here, this will be either on the left side or the right side. If it's on the left side, the expected height will then be minus lambda. If it's on the right side, it will be lambda. So the conditional expectation, as you observe more and more information, is a Martingale, right? So if I look at this expected height at z as I observe more and more information, this is something that's fluctuating up and down, and it's approximately this harmonic interpolation of minus lambda here plus lambda here, and eventually it either hits lambda or minus lambda, and so if I tell you where it is now and ask what's the probability it hits the plus lambda instead of minus lambda, well, since there are only two values it can hit, its expectation determines the probability, and the expectation I know is this harmonic interpolation. So,
Scott, this is the argument that if you have this phase separation and the limit exists, then it's SLE4.
Yes, that's right.
This is not the, does this give the argument that you have this phase separation?
Oh, the height gap?
Yeah, height gap.
No, the height gap lemma, as I say, this was a very complicated proof for us.
So you're not giving us any idea how this is done?
Well, I can tell you a rough idea. So this is the most technical part of our 132, I think it is, page paper. What we had to do was show that basically if I pick a point and do a random walk, stopping when it hits this path, then I want to show that the height at the point it hits. Just let me draw something. So I draw this path and I have my point. If I do a random walk, starting at this point, stop when it hits the boundary. And I would like to show that the sort of behavior in this ball, particularly the height of this vertex, is somehow independent of the macroscopic behavior. And it turns out that that's enough to push it through, because if I draw this whole path, I want to show that say if I were to probably do this again and run a different random path and hit this boundary, then I would get some different value. And I would like to say that that this value really doesn't depend, that it's concentrated. It's just the expectation is
okay.
The expectation is about minus lambda, regardless of what this path looks like. So basically, I choose a random path, I have this point, then there's a random measure. The measure is I do a random walk from here, stop when I hit this path. So that's now a random variable. Mm-hmm. The variable itself is random. And I'd like to show that the mean of this random variable, this random variable, is concentrated. And the way I would show that is show that if I generated two samples from this random variable, so I pick the random variable and then generate two samples from it, that they're sort of independent of each other. Okay. And how would I do that? Well, I really want to show that this behavior inside this little orange ball is roughly independent of everything else that goes on in the world. In particular, it's independent of this, what happens in this other orange ball. And to do that, you really need to kind of look at this thing on different scales. This picture here with an interface coming from far away and this random walk coming from far away. And show that I can kind of couple things so that at each scale I have some chance of coupling together. And that shows me that this here really, there's no way this can depend on what happens far away. It's sort of analogous to if I wanted to show for high temperature easing model that there's a unique Gibbs state. One way to do that would be to, so that means if I take a billion by billion grid and take whatever boundary conditions I want, it's not going to really affect the law of what happens on a little 10 by 10 grid in the center. And I want to show you this is kind of analogous to the high temperature easing model. I fix what happens outside, it doesn't really affect what happens locally.
Except the decay, I assume, is a lot worse.
What's that?
How fast the effect decays is probably a lot worse.
How fast the effect decays?
The effect of the boundary, the effect of the changes. I'm sure it's not, I mean, the easing system that you mentioned is going to be exponential. And so if it's very high temperature, you can detect
it. Yeah, that's right. It'll be some power law.
It's got to be a power
decay, yeah, that's right. That's a very rough idea. Okay. So now, the question, which is how do we get SLE kappa from the Gaussian field for kappa not equal to 4? And so first I'm going to tell you what you would probably think of as the most obvious way to construct a random geometry from the Gaussian free field. And this is something that I don't know so much about. I'm actually hoping I can get you guys to tell me more about this, but it's related to this quantum gravity and gravity's story, which is what I would think you would do is, if I give you some continuous approximation H of the Gaussian free field, I should endow the disk with the metric e to the h times dl, where h is, l is your sort of, this is your Euclidean length. And let me draw this for a minute here. So, two dimensions is very nice because we have this Riemann mapping theorem. So I give you some sort of random geometry, some sort of random surface, or any sort of surface, maybe it's the, a half of the globe, or but some sort of smooth, wild surface, it can have mushrooms, and but it's simply connected with boundary. Then there's going to be a conformal map from this onto the disk, or any simply connected domain. Let's make it a disk. And so there's a conformal map to the disk, and if I look at this, so if I look at this function g that conformally maps this random, this funny geometric surface to Riemannian geometry to the disk, I'm going to set this function h. I'll call h the log of g prime. Say. So. So this here is a function. This is a Riemannian manifold. In particular, I have a notion of length, and so at any point, if I have a conformal map, I can look at how the length gets distorted. What's the sort of derivative at that point? And that's all right. That by g prime, and the log of g prime, I'll call this function h. And so now, if I give you a path here, and I ask what is the length of this path in the preimage of this path in the manifold, what's the length of this preimage up here? Well, the length of this is just going to be the integral of the derivative of g inverse along this path with respect to Euclidean length. Right, so it'll be the integral of e to the h, or e to the minus h, I guess. So just the integral of, what do I make h minus this? So it's just the integral of e to the h along this path. Okay, so a natural thing you would think to do is say, let's take h to be an instance of the Gaussian free field. Now, why is that natural? Well, that's natural because so the Gaussian free, so first of all, this function is going to be, this metric will be flat, have zero curvature, if and only if h is harmonic. So the curvature of this metric at a point is going to correspond to the Laplacian of h. And so the Gauss free field is sort of, you take something that wants to be harmonic but kind of randomly perturbed by adding some noise. That suggests that if you think flat metrics are sort of the stable ones, canonical ones, that a randomly perturbed flat metric should be something like what you get by setting h to be the Gaussian free field. And it also, the Laplacian of h is a natural scaling limit of Coulomb gas models, where you have charged particles interacting. And so if you think of your positive curvature and your negative curvature as being charges, then it's sort of, this is a natural law for charge distributions to have some Laplacian. So the law for the curvature you get by making h the Gaussian free field is natural. But this is what you would think to try. Okay, now what happens if we do this? So let's take h to be a, so I'll project my Gaussian free field onto a 200 by 200 triangular grid, very fine triangular grid, some 80,000 triangles, and I'll start drawing some geodesics of this geometry. So here if I take h to be, if h were 0, the geodesics, if I start at a point, draw the geodesic flow, I would just get straight lines. If I take h to be a small multiple of the gas free field, 0.05, I start to get lines that curve a little bit. I take a bigger multiple and I see these paths actually start forming some loops. One times the Gaussian field, I start to see something like this. for my geodesic flows. Now remember, if I have a geometry here that has, say, mushrooms in it, if my surface has mushrooms, then I can have a geodesic that goes and wraps around the bottom of the mushroom several times and then heads off. Once you start on the geodesic, its trajectory is determined, but it can cross itself all over the place. So you get these paths that cross themselves, and anyhow, one thing I'm very interested in is, yes?
So just to clarify, when you say mushroom, you imagine some three-dimensional embedding or something?
Yeah, I'm imagining a three-dimensional embedding.
It's really intrinsic thing.
It's really intrinsic, right. But if I have, say, a H having a large value at some point surrounded by small values around the outside, I view that as a mushroom.
Yeah.
If you have it embedded in three dimensions, it could be. Yeah. Okay, so this is... Right, so I get an object like this. Yes, okay, what are these? I would like to know what these are. Is this just Brownian motion? Are these just really Brownian motions independent of the field and the scaling limit? Or is it something else? I don't know. That's the question. But this... But you could ask, if I take two points far away and look at the shortest path between them, is that going to look like some sort of an SLE? I don't know. I mean, this is very related. You know, in this Louisville quantum gravity papers, they take the action to be exactly what I take here, the integral of the gradient squared of h, where the metric is constructed this way. Plus, you can also weight by the area of h. But, you know, it's essentially this model, and I would love to understand more about when these things are SLEs. I'm hoping someone will tell me something. Okay.
Can I ask, in that picture, so these geodesics, they are locally choice, but they should also be global geodesics, right?
Yeah, that's right. So geodesic is not necessarily the shortest path between two points, just sort of locally has that property. So yeah, if you took two points and looked at really the shortest path, that would then be non-self-intersecting. And that might look more like an SLE. The trouble is that shortest path now doesn't have this locality property. See, when I did these level lines, it had this nice property that if I change the field off of the level line, that doesn't change the level line. And it turns out that locality property is incredibly convenient if you want to prove things. And so if I look at a geodesic in this metric, well, I don't have locality anymore. I don't know how to prove things with it, but I would love to. So hoping I can learn something from people this week on this problem. Okay. So what I actually did do is say, well, let's take the vector field e to the ih instead of e to the h. And, you know, if you like, it's basically I take the Levi-Civita connection corresponding to this, and I replace the rotations by, replace the dilations by rotations and vice versa. For people who didn't understand that, it's actually even simpler. What I do is I take at every point, e to the ih is a unit vector. It's a complex number on the unit circle. And I just represent that vector by an arrow pointing in that direction. And so I get an arrow at every point. And so here I take h of x, y to just be the function y, and I get this collection of arrows. Over any function h, I can get that. And now I have flow lines. And you can ask, here's something where I take h of x, y to the x squared plus y squared, I get these flow lines. And you can ask, what happens if I take h to be the Gaussian free field? So let me say, is there a way to define the flow lines when h is, when chi is a constant and I take e to the ih over chi? So is it some multiple of the continuum Gaussian free field? And the answer is yes. Turns out these flow lines can be constructed in their forms of SLE kappa, where kappa depends on chi via this formula. So chi over 4 to minus 1 half, minus chi over 4 to the 1 half.
Standard notation in physics is alpha naught for this one. It's the same alpha naught that we
get. Yes, that's right. All right. Maybe I should call it alpha naught. And I'll just show you some pictures. So these are with larger and larger multiples of the Gaussian free field. We get larger numbers. This particular number I like because it looks like the New Jersey transit system. And this is bigger multiples, and the higher the multiple, the more windy the path becomes.